The following is a ray gun armed, faster than light presentation of GalacticNetcasts.com. Hello, and welcome to episode number 9 of the Time Traveling Robots in Space podcast, where we talk about time travel, robots, and space in science fiction and science fact. I am the Inter Dave from Wausau, Wisconsin, alongside Paul Swickard from Glendale, California. How are you, Paul?
I'm doing very well. It's a Tuesday, and, you know, it's a good day to podcast.
It is. And before we start, I wanted to address a subject that we kind of got into last week, but my stupid memory, I couldn't remember the name of this certain concept. It's called the singularity. The full name is like the technological singularity. It's a concept developed by Ray Kurzweil. He's like this computer genius. And what it refers to is the... This is what I got off of Wikipedia, because I can't really explain it much better. The hypothetical future emergence of greater than human intelligence through technological means, since the capabilities of such an intelligence would be difficult for an unaided human mind to comprehend. The occurrence of a technological singularity is seen as an intellectual event horizon beyond which the future becomes difficult to understand or predict. So basically what it says is we get to a certain point and we get so melded with machine technology that between that and now there's such a difference that it's unrecognizable. I think
that, yeah, that's about the size of it. And people seem to be fairly familiar with this concept. We see it all the time.
Yeah, but it seems to be gaining more prominence, and I'm seeing it in a lot of different areas. I sent you a video earlier this week on Google Plus about the singularity, and it was hosted by that one Asian guy that seems to be on every single discovery or science-based program.
The physicist.
Yeah, yeah. And he's almost like more of a TV personality now than he is a physicist.
Yeah, he kind of rolls like a rock star, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He just kind of has that vibe.
Yeah. Also,
but, you know,
go ahead.
It was funny. I think I agree with him in terms of like his general attitude about it. He kind of put forth the idea that we should really embrace this thing rather than try to reject it. And, you know, I can understand that. I can relate. I think that's the right attitude to have.
But we can't let it control us.
Right.
I don't want to become a Borg someday. I don't want to be like a mindless drone.
Join us, Dave. It's so much happier here.
Resistance is futile. Or is it futile?
I think they always just said futile. I don't ever think they said futile.
I thought they said futile early on.
I don't know. I know that Data said futile.
Okay. I can imagine in my head Patrick Stewart as Jean-Luc Picard as Locutus saying futile.
Yes, I absolutely could. I hear you. That
okay,
would definitely.
Work. Okay, let's solve it now. If you're listening to this podcast and you know the answer, please write us galacticnetcasts@gmail.com. Oh, I wanted to also mention that another reason I brought the issue of singularity up is I was listening to the Nerdist podcast today, hosted by Chris Hardwick, one of my favorite podcasts. And their guest on the podcast, the latest episode, was comedian actor T.J. Miller, who was hilarious, by the way. And the last subject he brought up was the singularity. He's very interested in the future, futuristic stuff, things happening in the future, and he brought up the subject of singularity. So I thought that was very interesting.
That's very cool. Yeah, the Nerdist is definitely worth checking out.
All right. Are you ready to actually start this podcast officially?
Yeah, let's do it.
Katie says you disappeared for a couple days and didn't know it, and you went back in time.
Something like that. I saw Olivia.
Olivia's been dead for 9 years.
Olivia!
Do I know you?
Not yet.
This is going to sound crazy, but two people are going to die tonight.
The show is about a man who suddenly, involuntarily, is torn back and forth through time. He's torn between his past love of his life and his present love of his life, which is his wife. He has separate lives, truly separate lives, in different time periods.
That is from Journeyman. Did you ever see that show?
I have not seen Journeyman.
Journeyman was a program that was on maybe 3-4 years ago about this guy that would go back in time in his own lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget the reason why, or it's been a long time since I've seen the show, but it's worth looking up. I don't know if it's on Netflix, but I know that you can watch little bits and pieces where I got that off of YouTube. So,
okay.
But it involves time travel.
Cool.
Which is our first topic. And I'm up, so. Let me begin. Right now, people are going crazy over Batman Arkham City, as we have talked about on the show. Are you actually playing the game?
I am.
Okay.
I am going through it right now.
All like, right.
As we're doing a podcast, which is probably not a good idea. Okay, I'll stop.
You were playing the game as we were doing the podcast?
No, of course not. Okay. That would be silly.
But, the only reason that I brought that up was because one of my other podcast hosts, he'll do things as we're doing the podcast. He'll do other things as we're podcasting. He's great at multitasking. Anyways, but not everybody is talking about everyone's favorite wall crawler, Spider-Man, of course. Earlier this month, saw the release of Activision's Spider-Man Edge of Time, which is a follow-up to last year's Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions. The game follows Peter Parker, Spider-Man, battling Anti-Venom, who suddenly kills him. The game then takes you to the year 2099, and Miguel O'Hara, a.k.a. Spider-Man, who was investigating... you might have to help me out with this, because you maybe know more about this than I do.
Okay.
How do you pronounce that character's name?
Alchemax?
Yeah, Alchemax?
I think it's Alchemax.
Okay, Alchemax.
Like as an alchemist.
Okay. Alchemax's scientist, Walker Sloan, while spying on him, Miguel discovers Sloan's planning to travel back in time and found Alchemax in the past years before it was originally established. Miguel arrives just as Sloan enters his gateway, but jumps through the portal too late to stop him. Trapped between the timeline, Miguel sees visions of the original Spider-Man being killed by Anti-Venom, as history around him alters. Gameplay features a new cause and effect system where one Spider-Man's actions will affect the other and vice versa, and you can read the full review on the game at 411mania.com, which will have the link in the show notes section at galacticnetcast.com. Does this look interesting to you, Paul?
It does, and, you know, comic book games have somewhat of a torrid history. They usually aren't very good. So I'm just glad that people are taking the time to actually put effort in the quality of their work. And I'll definitely be checking this out.
Well, it's a competitive thing right now. Well, it's always has been competitive, but it seems like it's getting even worse.
That's true. It always has been. And now, you know, I mean, people are being a lot more, I guess, stringent with their use of, you know, just extra income. So people are a lot more picky about what they choose to spend their money on.
And there was more to the story. They were talking about the technical aspects of the game, and it sounds like the back end, the engine that runs this thing, is pretty kick-ass.
Good for them. That's always one of the more difficult parts of making those types of games is, you know, what engine is it going to run on and how does it work and all that kind of thing. Like, people have paid a lot of money to license engines. It's one of those things that is like kind of the, I guess you could think of it as the brain of the entire thing.
Yeah, I guess that would be the backbone. So if you have a crappy engine, you have a crappy game, right?
Most likely, yeah.
Okay. So if I was a game player, if I was a gamer, I would definitely pick this up.
Yeah. You should do it anyway.
So is this Spider-Man in 2099, is he a character in the actual comic book?
That I don't know. I would assume so, given just the kind of history they've put together here. I'm pretty sure all of the versions of Spider-Man that you see in the game are actually like alternate reality type stuff. or futuristic versions of, you know, the comic book series.
Okay. I wasn't sure, but that sounds about right.
I think so.
So is Anti-Venom the same as Venom, or is he a different guy?
I would assume he's different, because normally don't people go out of their way to say, you know, the Anti-Venom versus Venom. I mean, everybody knows Venom, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I would assume it's a different character, or maybe given, I don't know, given the alternate reality basis of all this, maybe it's a alternate version of Venom or a futuristic version of him.
Yeah, that could be too. All right. So this next story, the story that you have, you stole this from me.
I know. I'm sorry.
Well, it was funny because between the time that I took all of last week's stories down and the time that I went back to the document, you had put things in there, and I didn't look. I didn't look far enough ahead, and by the time I was done like editing my story and putting it all on there, I noticed that you had the same story. So go ahead, traitor.
I apologize. Excuse me. Magic Treehouse, which is a children's book series, is premiering in Japan as one of those anime style type films that starting to show up in film festivals and things like that. And so far, people are saying it's pretty awesome. So yeah, the Magic Treehouse series is essentially about these two kids who find a magic treehouse and go to all these different eras of time. And, you know, all of the, what you might expect out of children's books. But it's definitely very cool. Like, you have, I mean, it's a really popular series in Japan. Like, you're talking about a series of, I think it was like 47 different books, all different, from all different eras.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really neat. I think this would make a good movie.
And the author of the book series was very against handing over the rights to the story to filmmakers. But
yeah, I thought that was interesting. And then she said that it was then it seemed like she was for it. It seemed like she felt that it got the sort of captured the spirit of the series.
And it didn't hurt that they came to the States too.
No, I'm sure it didn't.
And didn't I read something like she's going to go to Japan and do something like use some money or help out an organization of some kind? Did you read that part?
I did. She's doing I don't know if it's for a specific charity, but I know she's going to a lot of the places that were hardest hit by the tsunami. And, you know, just try to help out the kids there.
Well, good for her.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was very cool.
I've never read any of those, but I'm curious now.
It may be one of those things where I have to, I might see the movie first, and then if it's any good, might check out the books.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So that's time travel. Let's move on to our next section.
In a distant future, in an age of intelligent machines, he is the first robotic child programmed to love and coexist as a member of a family. His is a tale of humanity and a journey to find his place among humans and machines.
I'm a boy.
You are a real boy. At least as real as I've ever made one.
We have kind of a theme going here because we just talked about the kid stories, and then I played the clip right there from AI, which was about that android who was a young kid.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm going to talk about a story that is based on a cartoon from the 1960s called Gigantor. You ever heard of it?
I've heard of Gigantor. I have not seen it.
Okay. I didn't know this. I didn't know anything about this show, this story. But Gigantor is an anime version of the Japanese show Tetsujin 28 Go, which features a very large robot controlled by a 12-year-old boy by remote, and it's being developed into a movie. Yeah. The original television show was on in the 60s, around the same time as Speed Racer. And it saw a mild resurgence in the 1990s. Brian Barber, who's known for directing music videos and the film Idlewild.
Idlewild, yeah.
Yeah. He bought the rights to Gigantor, including the toys in the comic. And he's shopping it around to movie studios right now. It's being described as Transformers meets the Goonies. And if you liked the Iron Giant, you're going to love the film version of Gigantor. Although, in the story, it doesn't say anything that if it's going to be a live action or an animated show.
That's a good question. I don't know. If the pedigree for this is definitely in anime, so animation would make sense. But, you know, it would seem like it would make a good live action movie too.
Yeah.
And he's comparing it. He's comparing that to Iron Giant, and I don't, anyone who's ever seen Iron Giant, it's a great movie.
And I hear, you know, that
it's beloved.
Yeah. I hear that when people watch it, they cry.
I could see that.
Yeah. Pretty emotional.
I am stronger than that, but I can understand that.
Okay. Okay. We can leave it at that.
Exactly. No need to go any further.
But this guy must have a lot of faith in the story to buy the rights. I mean, he's only a director. So he bought the rights to the story, including the toys and everything else surrounding it. And he's really betting, oh, wow. He's really betting a lot that this movie's going to get made.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine he thinks that if it's successful, it's a really, really good bet. But you're right, he's kind of putting all of his eggs in one basket.
You can check out, by the way, check out a video of a bunch of shots put together into kind of a collage that I found on YouTube, along with music by the 90s group Helmet. They did the theme song to it, I guess. When it made its big resurgence back in the 90s. But I found a video of shots from the show along with the song, and you can check that out in the show notes section at galacticnetcast.com for this podcast.
Very cool.
So what do you got as far as robots go, Paul?
Well, you know, Dave, we all knew this was coming. And but in reality, it actually is pretty cool. Robots are going to get a touch-sensitive skin. And basically, they came up with this synthetic material. It looks kind of like rubber, but it could potentially give an AI or something like that the same sensory input as though it were skin. So the ultimate goal being that, you know, an AI could use it, or you would have people like amputees actually being able to feel things where they would normally feel them.
Or Borg.
Or, yes. Exactly right.
Go ahead.
So, yeah, I thought this was awesome. This is being developed in Stanford and using, like, carbon nanotubes and things like that. But, in the article that I read, they were saying that finally, you know, we have the potential for sex robots.
Nice. It always comes back to sex, doesn't it?
It does. And again, the guy who said it was like, you know, all I really want to know is if the skin is lickable. And I was just like, huh, okay.
I see cool, where his mind is.
Yeah, exactly right. And by the way, this was from TechCrunch, so not exactly, you know, abstract.
Exactly. Well, I mean, this holds a lot of potential for, like you said, amputees. That's the biggest group of people that'll really benefit from this.
Yep. They mentioned amputees, burn victims, war, you know, people who have been injured in wars. But it's definitely very cool. You can see that. I'm sure we'll have the clip on the show notes, but
yep.
you can watch the, you know, minute and a half clip of what the skin is supposed to do. And you can see like how it reads information.
That's crazy, man. I'm telling you, singularity. It's coming.
And it started with Stanford. Let that be known.
Well, you know, going back to the whole amputee thing, there's a huge population of new amputees because of our actions in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I could really see, you know how they say that war helps technologies along? I think that this might be the case.
I hope so.
I don't know if the two are connected, but I could see one feeding off the other, you know?
Sure. I would like to see some good come out of it, you know? Like, you know, regardless of your feelings about how we spend money for war or whatever, I would like to at least get something, you know, positive out of the experience.
Well, only time will tell, I guess.
Yep.
All right. Are you ready to go into space?
We should go to space.
Oh, hang on. I forgot I had one more story. We have a bonus story in the subjects of robots this time.
You're doubling up on me, man. I can't keep up.
Well, this is huge because this story broke yesterday. The creator of Lisp and arguably the father of modern artificial intelligence, John McCarthy, died yesterday.
Oh, okay.
I don't have his age here, but he studied mathematics with the famous John Nash at Princeton and notably held the first computer chess match between scientists in the U.S. and USSR. He transmitted the moves by telegraph way before the internet. McCarthy believed AI should be interactive, allowing for a give and take similar to AI simulators like Eliza and more recently Siri.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
His own labs were run in an open, freewheeling fashion, encouraging exploration and argument. He won the Turing Award from the Association for Computing Machinery in 1972 and the National Medal of Science in 1991. So the father of AI, he's passed away.
I wonder what he would say. Like, you know, I wonder if there's anything recent on, like, what his impressions are of the most recent developments, like Siri and things like that.
Oh, I'm sure he wrote or said a lot about it.
Mm.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you'd guess that he might have a lot to say or had a lot to say about that stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, he will be missed.
All right, let's now go into space.
Planet Meta could be supporting life as we know it.
Yes, but the problem here may affect the Meta probe.
We must make a manned landing on Meta. Nothing will stop us.
I can't guarantee that they won't be affected 3 days or 3 months out into deep space.
The giant leap for mankind. It's beginning to look like a stumble in the dark.
That clip is from my recommendation this week, and to find out what it is, stay tuned. That's what they call a tease in the radio business.
They're clever.
All right.
I like it.
According,
it's like professional in here.
I know, man. See, this is what I bring to the table, professional radio broadcasting to a podcast.
Good on you.
That's my contribution to what we're doing here. Or whatever. I don't know. According to IndieWire.com, Scottish director Lynn Ramsey describes her next film as Melville meets science fiction. It's more or less inspired by Moby Dick, she says, so I'm working on something loosely based on that, and it's science fiction, so we're taking the premise into the galaxy. We're creating a whole new world and a new alien. It's a very psychological piece, mainly taking place in the ship, a bit like Das Boot, so it's very claustrophobic. The script is still being written by Ramsey, who is also working on visual and design elements for the movie. There's no clear timeline on the film yet, but in the meantime, you can see her latest movie called We Need to Talk About Kevin, which is being released in January. Other movies that she's directed include Ratcatcher and Morvern Caller. You ever heard of either of those movies?
I haven't. I was looking through this, and I'm like, she does not sound familiar to me.
No, but this movie that she's talking about making sounds really interesting.
Yeah, for sure. If you're going with the whole Moby Dick thing, obviously it's very psychological.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put that in a space context, it almost reminds me of one of the more recent Futurama episodes.
Fill me in.
Oh, that's right.
I don't watch Futurama.
Oh, see? Yet again, I have to milk this one. No, essentially, that it was a silly story about a giant space whale and somebody's, you know, absolute obsession with catching it.
Oh, so literal interpretation of Moby Dick then.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, yes, there was a literal whale in figurative space.
Okay.
So yeah, definitely. That definitely sounds interesting.
Have you seen Das Boot?
No.
Do you know what it is?
I'm trying to remember. I should know this. What is this?
World War One or World War Two submarine movie? I think.
Okay.
I know it was. I knew it was a submarine war movie. I don't remember if it's World War One or World War Two.
Okay.
But it's very interesting. It takes place. The whole movie takes place in this submarine, and it's very claustrophobic, and it's just amazing how well they pulled it off. And I believe it is on Netflix. If you want to put that in your queue and watch it,
it may be in my queue, but I definitely will. I'll have to do that.
Put that in your queue and watch it, buddy.
Exactly.
So, okay, I'm looking forward to that. What do you got for space?
So, two Texas students decided to launch a Nikon camera into space.
Cool.
And yeah, definitely. And probably the coolest part about this is that they're just two kids, more or less, and they said, "Hey, we should launch something into space." And yep, sure enough, they said, "Hey, we're going to launch it at 9 a.m. And really all it was it, they had a kind of like a launching little launching pad, and it was lifted up like a weather balloon.
Okay.
And it was very cool. They launched it at 9:02, and it touched down back on Earth at 11:56, so about 3 hours.
This sounds a lot like the guy that did almost the same thing, I want to say last year sometime, but it was a cell phone. And the way he found when it went back to Earth, the way he found it was using the GPS on the phone.
Yeah, yeah. That actually, you know, given today's tech, you should be able to do that relatively easily. Say, hey, I know exactly where my phone is.
Well, it's amazing how they do this, because all they do is take a balloon up, and then when it hits the atmosphere, or when it hits outer space, when it runs out of atmosphere, the balloon pops and goes back down again.
Yep, that was pretty much the whole idea. And you know, what was especially cool, they once they got it back, they uploaded all of the usable photos and loaded it onto their Flickr page. And some of them, they realized pretty much immediately that there was a lot of condensation on the camera lens, and it ruined some of the pictures. But see, they're already adapting and already trying to figure out like how to make it better, and they're already like planning a new launch date in like 2 weeks.
Wow, that's cool.
So yeah, and I mean they commented on this too. It's, you know, most people would take 3 to 6 months in doing something like this, and they did it in 13 days.
Kids, man.
Yep, good on them.
They're our future. Future engineers.
Crazy kids.
Are there pictures of the actual, on this article, are there pictures of the results?
There are. If you go down to the, we'll have this in the show notes, of course, but in the article, if you scroll down, there should be a link towards the bottom for Eric Leith's, that's the kid's name, Flickr page.
Okay.
It should be like one of the last links in the article. But yeah, all of the photos are uploaded there. Some of the horizon pictures are really cool. Like, you know, we say space, and it, sure enough, it was space.
That is awesome. Yeah, they look good.
Yeah. Yeah.
The last one at the very right, you can really see the Earth curve. No, not that one. The second one to the right.
Okay.
You can see really, you can see the curvature of the Earth and see the darkness of space. That's awesome.
Yeah. So, I will be following these guys up and seeing what their success is like when they launch again.
Cool. I look forward to it as well, and they picked a good camera, too. I'm a Nikon person.
I don't know very much. Like, I don't know the camera jargon very well. I would assume that Nikon is good.
Well, I mean, you're either in a Nikon camp or you're in a Canon camp. If you're like a real professional photographer, or if you're a super camera photography nut, and you have a nice DSLR, then you'll either pick Nikon or Canon, pretty much.
Okay.
But my next camera is going to be a Micro Four Thirds, and it's going to be Panasonic. So I'm going to go with neither of them.
So you're neither. You're a third party.
Yes, exactly. All right. Well, so awesome, let's move into the recommendations. And my audio clip was from Space 1999. You ever seen it, Paul?
No.
Okay. I understand. See, I don't watch. What's the show again? Futurama.
Futurama. Yeah.
You've never seen Space 1999, so we're even.
Okay. As long as we're even.
Even plane of existence here. Space 1999, a British science fiction TV series that ran for two seasons and originally aired from 1975 to 1978. So it sounds like it was spread out a little bit.
You're quite the fan of the British television, man.
Yeah. I dig it. Well, this is not really, it's not strictly British because it stars, the two main stars are American, but it was a British TV show.
Oh, wow. So they're like doing what we do all the time. Weird.
Yeah, I know. But they actually kept their American accents, unlike Hugh Laurie from House.
Exactly.
Who's British. And when you find out he's British, you're like, what?
You should, if any of you guys are interested, you should go back and actually see him in Blackadder, which is a British series. He will be almost unrecognizable.
Really?
You will not understand that that's Hugh Laurie.
Wow, okay. I saw that on Netflix.
First and foremost, he's a comedian.
Like, oh, yeah.
And it shows, and some of it's very, very funny.
So his funny housework, that is just a small smidgen of what he can do.
Pretty much.
Okay, so Space 1999 stars Martin Landau. I'm sure you've heard of him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Martin Landau, Barbara Bain. And the story begins in the opening episode when nuclear waste from Earth stored on the moon's far side explodes in a catastrophic accident on 13 November 1999, knocking the moon out of orbit and sending it and the 311 inhabitants of Moonbase Alpha hurtling uncontrollably into space. Could this actually happen? Probably not, but it's science fiction, so whatever.
Well, that's very cool.
The runaway moon, in effect, becomes a spacecraft on which the protagonists travel, searching for a new home. During their interstellar journey, the Alphans encounter a vast array of alien civilizations, dystopian societies, and mind-bending phenomenon previously unseen by humanity. This was one of my favorite shows when I was growing up, and I used to actually like play Space 1999. You know how you play when you, if you were a big fan of a certain show or a certain thing growing up, you'd always like pretend that you're in it or whatever.
Sure.
I've
never done that.
Okay, whatever. One of my favorite aspects of the show were the Eagle transporter ships, which they had the really cool shape because there was a cockpit at the front, the crew area cockpit, and then in the middle there was like a separate part of the ship that they could detach and put different things on it, kind of.
Uh-huh.
And then, that was one of my favorite parts of the show. And Space 1999 is not available on Netflix streaming, but if you do a little searching on YouTube, you'll find it there. I watched the first episode. I don't know if there's any more on there, but at least you can watch the first episode and start to get into it that way.
Cool. Good deal, dude.
So what's your recommendation, Paul?
I'm going to throw out a website called tested.com. And, I think about this name and I'm like, oh, this sounds horrible and I don't want to go to this website. No, it's essentially this group of guys testing all kinds of different tech. So it's actually pretty informative and I enjoy it quite a bit. Like the most recent thing, one of the more recent features they have is, you know, a lot of camera comparison shots between the iPhone 4S, the iPhone 4, and the Samsung Galaxy S2. And some of it even goes into the science fiction type era as well. Like, for example, they have the whole Stanford building a capacitor sensor that has skin, like we just talked about. And there's some good stuff in here. Google, they talk about Google's self-driving cars, for example, or a variety of other things. And they also, one another favorite of mine is they discussed why artificial computer voices are typically female.
What was their explanation?
Well, there's multiple reasons for it, and a lot of them make sense. You know, some of it is one portion of it is strictly just stereotypes. You know, like women having certain jobs. That's one possible reason. Another reason is sometimes it's typically pragmatic. Like if you're in an environment that has a low hum, like a train or something like that, you're going to more easily hear a woman's voice than a man's.
Okay, that's the explanation that makes the most sense.
Yep. That, I agree. And that tends to make sense for me as well.
So the question I have is, if HAL 9000 would have been a female, would HAL 9000, what I'm trying to say, apparently I can't speak English right now.
No, it's cool.
Do you think if HAL 9000 was a female, all that stuff would have happened in the movie?
Yes, because I've seen GLaDOS in the Portal games, and absolutely it'll happen.
Okay, all right. Okay.
But yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. If you're into technology at all, whether it be futuristic or, you know, purely practical, definitely worth your time.
So if you're like curious about a phone and you have questions about, you know, how it compares to another phone, is this the kind of website to go to?
This is the place to go. Yes, Okay. Absolutely. On a monthly basis, they'll do a rundown. Like, it being almost the end of October now, they're going to come up with a monthly deal on which phone they would recommend that people get per carrier.
Okay.
So definitely when I'm in the market for a new phone, I'll be checking these guys out.
Especially if you're in a more of a Android or Windows Phone 7 mode.
Pretty much.
Because, I mean, the iPhone's the iPhone.
Yep. That's pretty much the reason. I mean, if you've already said, okay, I don't want to do the whole iPhone thing, then you definitely want to check this out.
Cool.
And even then, like, you know, they'll do typical, you know, benchmark comparisons of speed and, you know, different pieces of functionality, that kind of thing.
Yeah, because there is a difference between, like, the iPhone 4S and the iPhone 4.
Sure. There's a big one.
Camera.
And, you know, hardware, and even in the camera. Like, you can see from these nifty comparison shots.
Was this the website that put together all the, like, all the generations of the iPhone, the pictures taken?
I've seen multiple websites do it.
Okay.
I don't know that it was here, but the one they did most recently is the comparison between the 4, the 4S, and the Galaxy.
Okay. All right. Cool.
Yep.
So tested.com, exactly the way it's spelled.
Exactly.
Okay. One final thing to do, and then we're out of here. Question of the week. What's your favorite human-looking android in TV or movies, and why?
You know, I gotta go with Sonny. I realize he's not completely human looking, but he does have the whole facial feature thing. And I like Sonny for my robot.
Sonny? Which person?
We've talked about him before.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah. I was thinking, for some reason, I was thinking AI.
Oh, yeah.
Because I played the clip earlier from AI.
No, Sonny. I firmly believe he could have been the next big action star. He was that good.
Yeah, we talked about iRobot way back in episode 1, I think, right?
I think that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, I like Sonny too. Sonny could kick some serious ass, that's for sure.
How about yourself, sir? What would you be your favorite human-looking android?
I am going to go with Data from Star Trek, The Next Generation, and the films after that. I think what was appealing to me for Data was his ongoing search for humanity, being more human.
Yep. He was the heart of the Enterprise.
Yeah. And you know what? Once he got that emotion chip in his matrix, he seemed to lose a little bit of charm.
You think?
Yeah, because he could turn it off and turn it on.
Yeah.
So if he wanted to be more emotional, just turn on the chip.
It's true. Well, I mean, I think it was Picard who said, Data, I envy you, when he was, you know, feeling fear in front of the Borg and saying, hey, I should turn off this particular emotion.
First Contact, the best Star Trek movie, I think.
I liked that one a lot. I really did.
Well, you know what? Hang on one second. I'm not going to say best Star Trek movie. I think for me personally, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan is my favorite. But then First Contact, I think, is pretty much second.
Mm. I think that's a commonly held, you know, I think people agree with that.
The one thing that I really kind of am mad at the creators of Star Trek was killing off Data in the last movie.
Yeah. I mean, I really enjoyed all of the Next Generation movies. And that one, I don't know. I felt like, I understand you want to feel like there's some sense of loss and you want to feel that, you know, nobody on the Enterprise is, above death, basically. But, yeah, it just makes me feel weird. I don't want Data to die. Data can't die. He's an android.
And there's still a little piece of Data in, what was the replacement?
B4.
Okay, B4. That's right.
Yeah.
And that was, he was also made by Dr. Sung, right?
Yes. Yes, okay. He was.
So it was before was before Lore, right?
I don't know the lineage. I don't know in the order in which they were created.
It's been a long time since I've watched that last movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right, so that is it for this podcast, Time Traveling Robots in Space. We are doing episode 9. How do you feel it went?
I liked episode 9. You know, it's getting stronger.
We're getting better all the time. I can feel it.
And you know what? Episode 10, I'm going to go on a limb here. I'm going to say it's even better.
You're going to do some procrastinating. what's the word that sounds like that?
I don't know what word you're looking for.
Forecasting?
Yes, absolutely. I am predicting that this will be better.
Okay, so we'll find out in a week's time when we come back with episode 10 of the Time Traveling Robots in Space podcast. So if people want to follow us, like, for example, if they want to subscribe to the podcast, how do they go about doing that?
They should go to galacticnetcasts.com. That is the place to go for all of these wonderful podcasts. And it's not just this one, and I know you all love this one, but you should do more.
We've got the Alien Invasion podcast, which may or may not happen for a second week in a row this week because I have a job interview, so I'm screwing the whole thing up. Alien Invasion podcast, we have the Sci-Fi Film School podcast. Those are both weekly podcasts. And then we have the Science Fiction Daily Science Fiction News podcast. So all those available at galacticnetcast.com, including all the show notes from this episode of the Time Traveling Robots in Space podcast.
How dare you get life in the way of podcasting? What is wrong?
I'm sorry. See, the thing is, I'm running out of money, and I need a job.
No, I understand. Of course, I get it.
All right, so if you like us, go ahead and give us 5 stars on iTunes and leave a review. And you can also follow us on all the social networks like Twitter at Galactic Netcast without the S. And then we're on Facebook and Google Plus. You can leave us feedback. The email address is galacticnetcast@gmail.com. What's the phone number, Paul?
The phone number, once again, is area code 805-328-3966.
Call that right now and leave a voicemail. You can say anything you want. Hopefully relating to the podcast. That would be nice. But feel free to add something weird at the end.
You know, I'm in a movie theater and everybody's staring at me. I gotta go.
The Borg. They're all Borg. The singularity is here. This has been a presentation of Galactic Netcasts. To subscribe to this and our other podcasts, go to galacticnetcasts.com.